Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We're up to Epilogue 1, Chapter 12. When Pierre and his wife entered the drawing room, the Countess was in one of her habitual states in which she needed the mental exertion of playing patience. Sorry, my phone beeped there. And so, though by force of habit she greeted him with the words she used always when Pierre or her son returned, after an absence, "High time, my dear, high time. We were all weary of waiting for you, well, thank God," and received her presence with another customary remark, "It's not the gift that's precious, my dear, but that you give it to me, an old woman." It was evident that she was not pleased by Pierre's arrival at that moment, when it diverted her attention from the unfinished game. She finished her game of patience and only then examined the presents. They consisted of a box of cards of splendid workmanship, a bright blue Sevres teacup with shepherdesses depicted on it, and with a lid, and a gold snuff box with the Count's portrait on the lid, which Pierre had done by a miniaturist in Petersburg. The Countess had long wished for such a box, but she did not want to cry just then, so she glanced indifferently at the portrait and gave her attention chiefly to the box for cards. "Thank you, my dear. You have cheered me up," said she, as she always did, "but best of all you have brought yourself back, for I never saw anything like it. You ought to give your wife a scolding. What are we to do with her? She is like a mad woman when you are away, doesn't see anything, doesn't remember anything," she went on repeating her usual phrases. "Look, Anna Timofeyevna," she added to her companion, "see what a box for cards my son has brought us." Belova admired the presents and was delighted with her dress material. Though Pierre, Natasha, Nicholas, Countess Mary, and Denisov had much to talk about that they could not discuss before the old Countess, not that anything was hidden from her, but because she had dropped so far behindhand in many things that had they begun to converse in her presence, they would have had to answer inopportune questions and to repeat what they had already told her many times, that so-and-so was dead and so-and-so was married, which she would again be unable to remember. Yet they sat at tea round the samovar in the dressing room from habit, and Pierre answered the Countess's questions as to whether Prince Vasily had aged and whether Countess Mary Alexeyevna had sent greetings, and still thought of them, and other matters that interested no one, and to which she herself was indifferent. Wow, that was one sentence. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. That's about 200-word sentence. No kidding. Conversations of this kind, interesting to no one but unavoidable, continued all through tea time. All the grown-up members of the family were assembled near the round tea table at which Sonya presided beside the samovar. The children with their tutors and governesses had had tea, and their voices were audible from the next room. At tea, all sat in their accustomed places, Nicholas beside the stove at a small table where his tea was handed to him, Milka, the old grey Barazoi bitch, daughter of the first Milka, with a quite grey face and large black eyes that seemed more prominent than ever, lay on the armchair beside him. Denisov, whose curly hair, moustache and whiskers had turned half grey, sat beside Countess Mary with his general tunic unbuttoned. Pierre sat between his wife and the old Countess. He spoke of what he knew might interest the old lady, and she could understand. He told of external social events and of the people who had formed the circle of her contemporaries, and had once been a real, living, and distinct group, but who were now, for the most part, scattered about the world and, like herself, were garnering the last ears of the harvest they had sown in early years. But to the old countess, those contemporaries of hers seemed to be the only serious and real society. Natasha saw by Pierre's animation that this visit had been interesting, and that he had much to tell them but dare not say it before the old countess. Denisov, not being a member of the family, did not understand Pierre's caution, and being as a malcontent much interested in what was occurring in Petersburg, kept urging Pierre to tell them about what had happened in the Semenovsk regiment, then about Arakcheev, and then about the Bible Society. Once or twice Pierre was carried away and began to speak of these things, but Nicholas and Natasha always brought him back to the health of Prince Ivan and Countess Mary Alexeyevna. "Well, and all this idiocy, Gosner and Tatarinova?" Denisov asked. "Is that really still going on?" "Going on?" Pierre exclaimed. "Why, more than ever. The Bible Society is the whole government now." "What is that, Monsieur Army?" asked the Countess, who had finished her tea, and evidently needed a pretext for being angry after her meal. "What are you saying about the government? I don't understand."
"Well, you know, maman," Nicholas interposed, knowing how to translate things into his mother's language, "Prince Alexander Golitsyn has founded a society, and in consequence has great influence, they say."
"Arakcheev and Golitsyn," incautiously remarked Pierre, "are now the whole government. And what a government! They see treason everywhere and are afraid of everything."
"Well, and how is Prince Alexander to blame? He is a most estimable man. I used to meet him at Mary Antonovna's," said the Countess in an offended tone, and still more offended that they all remained silent, she went on. "Nowadays everyone finds fault. A gospel society, well, and what harm is there in that?" And she rose, everybody else got up too, and with a severe expression sailed back to her table in the sitting room. The melancholy silence that followed was broken by the sounds of the children's voices and laughter from the next room. Evidently some jolly excitement was going.
"Finished, finished!" little Natasha's gleeful yell rose above them all. Pierre exchanged glances with Countess Mary and Nicholas. Natasha, he never lost sight of, and smiled happily.
"That's delightful music," said he.
"It means that Anna Makarovna has finished her stocking," said Countess Mary.
"Oh, I'll go and see," said Pierre, jumping up. "You know," he added, stopping at the door, "why, I'm especially fond of that music. It is always the first thing that tells me all is well. When I was driving here today, the nearer I got to the house, the more anxious I grew. As I entered the anteroom, I heard Andrusha's peals of laughter, and that meant that all was well."
I know the feeling," said Nicholas. "But I mustn't go there. Those stockings are to be a surprise for me."
Pierre went to the children, and shouting and laughter grew still louder.
"Come, Anna Makarovna," Pierre's voice was heard saying, "come here into the middle of the room, and at a word of command, one, two, and when I say three, you stand here, and you in my arms, well now."
"One, two," said Pierre, and a silence followed.
"Three." And a rapturously breathless cry of children's voices filled the room.
"Two, two," they shouted.
This meant two stockings, which by a secret process, known only to herself, Anna Makarovna used to knit at the same time on the same needles, and which, when they were ready, she always triumphantly drew one out of the other in the children's presence.
All right, there we go, another chapter down. Quickly, I'm going to do an advertisement. Please, if you are thinking of hosting your own podcast and you're looking for somewhere to host it online, please consider Podbean. I use Podbean for this very podcast that you're listening to, and I find them to be excellent. If you go to podbean.com/ander, you can get the first month of hosting for free. Podbean.com/ander. Thank you for your patience. All right, I must also apologize for that reading. It was quite bad. I was kind of stumbling over my own words quite a lot there. It's a late one. I played Dungeons and Dragons tonight with some buddies, and it went late. And I did quite a lot of talking as well, and my voice is all hoarse. And anyway, that's my excuses. So I apologize for the rather poor quality reading tonight. Anyway, we got through it though. And it was a nice chapter, actually. Everyone's kind of looking after the old countess, and Pierre's in good spirits, and the whole household is in relatively good spirits, so that was nice. Chattelvalsa said, "We see how everyone in the house tries to adapt to Countess Rostov when she's around. Is this out of necessity, love, or anything else? And how do you react to how they interact with Countess Rostova?" I think if you've ever lived with someone who's sort of going a bit on the senile side, you'll know what's going on here. You have to keep the conversation at a level where they can participate. Otherwise, they either sort of check out, or they might get frustrated that they don't know what anyone's talking about. Or you are going to have to be constantly explaining to them what you're talking about, because they're just going to be completely lost. So, everyone wants to be talking about Petersburg, but they are also aware that they should probably wait until the Countess goes to sleep, right? They're all aware of that, except for Denisov. He's not really clued into how this works, so he keeps pushing Pierre for details about Petersburg, and he's not sure why they're not so forthcoming with that conversation. It all makes sense to me, actually. Chattelvalsa, that scene played out. It was actually very, very relatable for me. Pierre says that the joyful screams of the children confirm for him that everything is all right. This is Chattelvalsa's comment. Do you think this is a sentimental or classic reaction, and why is this mainly caused by the joy of the children? Absolutely. I think, I don't know, the laughter of children, right? That's what makes him feel like he's home and he's back where everything's okay. De Fleury said, kids today watching X-rated movies on their personal iPads, they have no idea what it was like in the good old days when we all gathered around to watch Anna, what's-her-name, finish a pair of knitted stockings. Ooh-ah. They did have a lot of fuss about this, this knitting thing that Anna was doing, creating stockings, but it does also sound quite cool that she could knit two stockings in one. And Libby Stitch has linked us to a Revelry.com thing, which is two socks in one War and Peace method. And there's actually a little description on how to do this. It might actually be instructions. What is it called? Like knitting instructions? A pattern. I think it's called a pattern. There you go. So you can do it yourself. My mum actually is a big knitter. So mum, if you're listening, check that out. The two socks in one War and Peace knitting spectacular. And maybe your grandchildren will be enthralled to watch you do that. De Fleury said, I wish I could upvote this twice. If even Pierre's ridiculous baby wrangling is real and the magic knitting, does that mean that somebody somewhere right now is tying a policeman to a bear? It could be. It could be. This is all true stuff, De Fleury. 100157 said, I kind of think LT is pretty warmly in favor of how Natasha and Pierre are living. Wait, who's LT? Leo Tolstoy. Duh. Happily, honestly, in a big loving mess. They don't bow to convention or hold salons or live beyond their means or cut people down for social climbing or have other nasty faults. This is a happily happy family, and if Natasha dresses sloppy or puts on a few pounds, who cares? She's being authentic. Caucus Tree says, Does it sound abominable to anyone else how patronizing the Countess's interactions are made to appear? Is it patronizing, they're patronizing the Countess, or the Countess is being patronizing? Banana bread lover said yes, and it only exacerbates my own image of Tolstoy. I'm very disappointed. I thought he was more of a liberal leftist for his time, which in some way he was. He left his books royalty free at the end of his life so everybody could have access to them. However, how biased he is against Napoleon, all the chapters ranting about how all the historians are wrong and he is right about a war that he didn't even experience, and his terrible and misogynistic view of women makes me sick. I saw in a movie documentary, The Last Station, that the book was actually written by his wife while he dictated it. I wonder what she thought about how his husband viewed women. Sorry for the English, I'm not a native speaker. Libby Stitch said, I feel like Tolstoy's misogyny has really ramped up towards the end of the book. An interesting character like Helena is dispatched with an hurrah, she's dead, move on. Natasha is old and fat, so who cares about her anymore? Sonia is a shriveled up barren flower, and plain boring Maya managed to get married so she can forget all about her rich inner life and values and just focus on whether her idiot husband is upset with her. If his wife did do the writing, I imagine she was scowling at him throughout this section. I know I've been reading it with such an expression. Yeah, wow. I didn't notice all those things. Like, I know life didn't always turn out the best for a lot of the characters in the book, including the women. But, yeah, I mean, Sonia being a shriveled up barren flower, and Maya becoming sort of obsessed with her husband's values. Doesn't bode well. I can't help but think that, I'm not sure, but Banana Bread Lover, he seems frustrated with Tolstoy for being patronizing towards the Countess, like they're all treating her like an idiot sort of thing. But I think that might be, it's kind of actually a kindness. So when someone begins to go a bit senile, it's a kindness to them not to talk about things that are beyond them being able to follow. Because what they do, it's actually quite difficult to watch, is they sort of try to bluff their way through a conversation, and they act like they know what you're talking about, and they get embarrassed when, like, you know, if they get pushed for details when they were bluffing and pretending they knew what they were talking about, and then you push them for details or you inquire further, and it can be just really awkward and embarrassing, and you can tell it's actually quite stressful for them to try to keep up with a conversation, it provokes a bit of anxiety out of them, and so them struggling, it's like they're drowning in a conversation. So the reason that you don't engage in a conversation that will be beyond them is actually out of sort of a kindness to them, right? So it's not patronizing. I don't see it as patronizing. I just see it as it's an unfortunate thing. So they're not like, oh, let's not talk about this until the dumb old Countess is gone, because she's just going to bother us with questions. It's more like, hey, let's wait until she's gone, because we don't want to get her confused and upset. The one thing I don't see is this hate towards Natasha, like saying Natasha is old and fat, so who cares about her anymore? I don't feel like that's Tolstoy's attitude at all. I think he's actually, he's made her a natural progression of from one beauty to another. Like, she starts a young, naive, innocent beauty, and then becomes that kind of wayward, volatile kind of beauty, and then she matures, and she becomes like quite a beautiful mother, right? I don't see her as frumpy. I don't see her as fat. And he even said himself that she's more beautiful now than when she was younger, right? So she's become a bit serious, you know, and not quite as like playful and naive as before, but she's come out of that and just into being a mother with a pretty solid head on her shoulders. All right, it's very late, so I'm going to wrap up this episode here. Thank you very much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.